Welcome to Chapter 4, arguably the second most important chapter after Chapter 1, where we learn about the eternal struggle between risk and return. But mutual funds are so important for people who will never take Business 123 Introduction to Investments, will never want to decide what are the best investment options for them. Why? Because the chances are very, very good, dear students, that no matter where you work, you're going to be offered some kind of employer-sponsored plan. Or you're going to want to open up a Roth IRA or some other type of individual retirement account. If only because you realize, and I hope the media has done a good job of this, that saving for retirement is more and more on the shoulders of you. Whereas in the past, it was a task that was done by your employer, and they did it on your behalf. But now, with 401ks, 403bs, other types of employer-sponsored plans, you're in charge, which makes more sense because people don't work for the same company for 30, 40 years. And the opportunity to have a wonderfully funded retirement is very good if you start investing early, are consistent, prudent, don't get too greedy, too cocky, and don't panic when the markets fall. Have I said this before? I think I have, right? So we titled this chapter Mutual Funds. Investments for the masses. Let's get started on slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? Well, as we learned in chapter 1 in our overview of the investment universe, a mutual fund is an investment company that invests its shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities, which is a fancy way of saying they invest on your behalf. Investment company is the legal term. And as we said in chapter 1, I sure do wish that this were more popular than mutual fund, because you're not going to hear investment company unless you happen to work in the industry. You're going to hear mutual fund. And I understand, you know, it makes sense, mutual fund, right? Lots of people putting their money together. But investment company says it even better. They are in charge of the investments. You want car, you go to a car company. You want shoes, you go to a shoe company. You want insurance, go to an insurance company. Don't go to an insurance company for investments. And remember, I'm an insurance agent. You want investments, you go to an investment company. Does that make sense? I think so. Now, what are the two wonderful things we get from mutual funds? Professional money management and diversification. Yes, and I hope you know you remember that for the exam, because I'm going to ask you, you know, why do we, what are good, how would you explain mutual fund to somebody in, you know, two or three sentences, to somebody who has no idea of what they are? And you would mention something along the lines that the money is managed on your behalf by professionals who, some are very good, some are not so good. And you get instant diversification. Whereas when you're investing on your own, it's a little difficult to build up your own well-diversified portfolio, especially if you don't have a whole lot of cash to start off with. Each fund has a specific objective. They have a strategy, if you will, for investing. And there are over 12,000 funds to choose from. But wait a minute. Are there 12,000 different breakfast cereals in the well, it seems like it. No. Are there 12,000 different types of cars? No. How come there's 12,000 mutual funds? Well, as we're going to see, the mutual fund industry has exploded, and there's a few attributes about mutual funds that make them very, very easy to open. If you have enough money and enough talent, you don't need a factory. You just need somebody who is savvy with money management. And even then, you don't even need somebody that's savvy. and you need some cash behind you, and you can start a mutual fund. And also, we're going to see that there has been a movement to just have as many different mutual funds as possible, give people as many choices as possible, which seems to have backfired a little bit for some people. And as we also mentioned, many people choose mutual funds for their retirement account investments, 401ks, 403bs, the traditional IRA, the Roth IRA, the simple, the solo 401ks and the like. So they're very, very popular. Slide number 3. Here's my surefire graph that I made myself. Are you proud of me? I'm not very artistic. But here we are. We're the little people, and more of them are women, thankfully. And we give our money to the people in the top hats, and more of them are women. Why? Because it's already been shown that women make better investors than men. Statistically, I'll leave it to you to decide why that is, dear students. And they create a pool of money. I know it kind of looks like a potato, but it's actually a pool of money, and that's what's called the mutual fund, the investment company. And if they buy stocks, it's called a stock mutual fund. And if they buy bonds, it's called a bond mutual fund. And if they buy the short-term securities we learned about in Chapter 1, it's called a money market mutual fund. And then what we're going to see is that there are many, many different strategies and many, many different types of mutual funds. And the beginning, when the balkanization, which is a fancy way of saying the breaking up of, started with the balance fund that invests both in stocks and bonds, which turns out is actually a pretty good strategy. And we'll talk about that much later on in the semester. But you get some growth from stocks and some income from bonds and some volatility from stocks and some stability from bonds. So balance funds are a great choice for people who are really, really frightened of the markets. And especially they become very useful to you as you get older. You young folks, you don't need them. But hey, everybody's different. We'll talk about this later on. Slide number 4. Look at the growth of the industry. Back in 1940, when the Investment Company Act of 1940 was created, which essentially set the mutual fund industry in stone, there were 70 mutual funds. Yeah, what? Before the... Yeah, these mutual funds had evolved starting in the 1920s, and then grown throughout the 30s, and the regulators were a little, what's going on here? What are these things anyway? And so the Congress got together, and that shows that the Republirats and demagogues can play nice in the sandbox when they want to. Not now. and they created the mutual fund industry, the investment company industry. 30 years later, it had grown to 350, 600 in 1980. And then in 1990, look at that, from 600 to 2000. And then from 1990 to 2000, it had grown to 9,000 funds. That was the 2 decades where stocks went in 2 directions, up and way up. And then it sort of tapered off a little bit, the growth, obviously. But here, we're up at the end of 2018, according to the ICI, investmentcompanyinstitute.org website, they published their fact book, which is a truly motherload of information. Now it's gone global, and it comes out around May or June or so. So we'll get that information for 2019 in a few months. But it's a wonderful, especially if you love statistics. I'm sorry, statistics, right? And I do. And so I pour through this thing. It's also good if you have some insomnia at night, because it tends to be very dry. So very good for going to sleep. But can you imagine 12,000 funds? What is going on? Well, we'll see. We'll see when we... In a couple more presentations, we'll see how the industry just exploded with different varied options, and everybody's going to have this type of mutual fund and that type of mutual fund. If one company has it, then they all have to have it. And so it's one company, Fidelity, has over 500 mutual funds. Figure that one out. Slide number five. In 1980, 5 million Americans owned mutual funds, holding just 3% of their household financial assets. But as of December 2018, according to the Investment Company Institute's fact book, 101.6 million Americans in 57.2 million households own mutual funds. Folks, that's almost half, almost 45% of all U.S. households. Why? Because of employer-sponsored plans where people are offered a 401k, a 403b, and the like at work. Mutual fund assets now totaled, as of 2018, and remember, 2019 was a pretty good year, so it's actually more now, pretty good year in stocks, $21.4 trillion. Holding 21% of their financial assets. They are now the nation's largest financial intermediary. That means they hold money for somebody else, followed by banks and insurance companies. Insurance companies, yes. Life insurance companies are often called the invisible bankers, right? And they are very, very much into holding people's assets. Well, anybody. If anybody, they'll love to hold your assets, yes. Well, they just don't hold them. They do something with them. In the case of mutual funds, they hold them on your behalf and then invest on your behalf. What do banks do with your money? Right. They lend it out to other people. They pay you 0.1%, maybe a little bit more, as you saw in Chapter 1, depending on where you go. And then they charge the people they lend it to 21.9% on their credit card. Yeah, okay. Anyway, and then life insurance companies, what do they do with the money? Same thing. They invest it, but not on your behalf, on their behalf. And don't ever trust it. You need life insurance, folks? Talk to me or go take Business 121 Financial Planning and Money Management, Chapter 10. Buy term and invest a difference, but don't invest with a life insurance company, folks. It's not going to work out well for you. It'll be great for the agent. This is where I get myself in trouble, because remember, I'm an agent. And I think these whole life policies are poo-poo caca, and they're terrible. And that's why we tell people to buy term and invest the difference. But it gets the agents really angry, because that's how they make their boat payments, because the commissions on these things are huge. So I digress, but I just want to warn you, take Business 121. Or if not, just go to my website and look up Chapter 10 on financial planning and money management. Or give me a call. If you have children, you need life insurance, folks, pretty much. If you don't have children, if you're not married, you don't need life insurance. It's that simple. Slide number six. The growth of the mutual fund assets. What's happened? Well, we start with their data back in 2007 when we had $13 trillion, which was a record number. It had been growing steadily, even with the bear market of 2000 to 2002. But then we hit 2008, and look at the drop. Yeah, wow. It was a brutal year for stocks, and bonds actually went down, but nowhere near as stocks. But then we started creeping back up again, yay, until finally at the end of 2018, we're looking at $21.4 trillion. Now, folks, that is more, a little bit more, not much more, but a little bit more than the gross domestic product of the United States. So that's a significant, you and I just cannot understand the number 1 trillion. It's just too big for us. It's hard to get your hands around a billion, let alone a million. A million we can relate to because we see how much houses cost and the like. But $1 billion? And then that's a thousandfold increase. And then another thousandfold increase is a trillion. So it just doesn't make any sense. But when the data comes out in May, we should see that that number has gone up fairly, not that significantly, but 2019 was a very good year for stocks. So we should see that bump up a bit, and we will. Slide number seven. So what are the advantages of mutual funds? Well, you get instant diversification, which we talked about, and sometimes called pooled diversification, a process where investors buy into a diversified portfolio of securities for the collective benefit of the individual investors. And this is cool. Diversification is good. Don't let anybody tell you differently. There are some people who believe that you should not be diversified. You should buy just a few individual stocks or a few individual whatever bonds. But that's their decision. For the vast majority of us folks, we just want to have the knowledge that our investments are going to do well over time and we don't have to make a killing. So we want to be diversified. You've heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. We'll come back to it over and over and over again, especially when after when we've gone through stocks and bonds, and then we'll come full circle. So individually, when we're putting $50 a month away, it's very difficult for us to get diversification. But in a mutual fund, it's instant. Your $50 gives you 25 cents of Home Depot and 50 cents of Nike and maybe 70 cents of Microsoft. You see how that works? You don't worry about that. They take care of all the pennies here and there. So that's very cool. And then you get professional money management. The money managers, the mutual fund managers, the portfolio counselors, sometimes called the star managers, they're supposed to know what they're doing, and they certainly do get paid well enough. Some do very, very well. Others, not so well. And others don't do anything, as we'll see. All they do is look up a list of stocks and buy them. And if it's not on the list, they don't buy them. So in that respect, they don't have to be very smart. But the ones who are very smart, who are very good at what they do, they are worth it. In my humble opinion, dear students, you're going to hear different opinions. But of course, I'm right. Also, what we don't often talk about is the low initial outlay of capital. But it's so important for the vast majority of us. $50 a month. Some people will say, I don't know. I don't have enough money to get started investing. I say, what's your cell phone payment? And they go, well, it's usually $80. It's supposed to be $40, but I download a lot of ringtones. There's your in a mutual fund contribution, $50, $60, $70 a month, more if you can afford it. And the PETA factor. What? What's the PETA factor? I got this from the Wealthy Barber. I wish I had made it up. Pain in the... Yes. When it comes to mutual funds, folks, once you've decided on which fund or funds you're going to buy, there's nothing more for you to do. You know, look at them every 6 months, a year or so. But if you've done your research, you're going to stick with it for 5, 10 years maybe. And so there's nothing more for you to do. You've done your job and now it's their job. So the PETA factor is very low, the pain in the factor. Whereas something like real estate, yeah, the PETA factor is off the scale. Now, what are the disadvantages? What are the drawbacks? Well, you know, it's not free. You don't want people to work for you for free, do you? Some people do, but I have a little joke that goes along with that, but I won't tell it now. But eventually the guy gets his. He thinks he's getting over on somebody, and he actually winds up getting... So there are transaction costs involved. Some mutual funds charge a sales fee, a sales load, whereas many are no loads. But you have to be careful because some no-load funds can wind up costing you more than load funds over time. Huh? How's that? Because of the annual operating expenses. Anywhere from 0.5% to 2% or more, some of these mutual funds will charge. Now, what are we talking about? Say you have $100 in the mutual fund. A 1% annual operating expense will be $1. And we'll discuss this in detail, in more detail than you want to be discussed, but you're going to learn it in our next presentation because it is so important for you to understand this. Why? Because you want to know how you're being charged. It's so important, dear students. And you're going to be the guru. You're going to be the genius for your friends and family and coworkers. And you can't let them down. So they are going to depend upon you. You see, I'm setting you up here. They're going to depend upon you to understand what's going on. And you will. You will. It's not that hard. It's tedious, right? And so we're going to slog through that in our next presentation. And another drawback of mutual funds is that many mutual fund managers don't match the market's performance. Huh? Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they're doing? Well, there are various reasons for this. Some do. Some earn their keep, dear students. Don't get me wrong. Others, not so much. And we're going to see that in our next presentation, how some can outperform the market over time or do about the same as the market, whereas some could trail the market badly. And so that's where you come in. You need to find the folks who've done well over the long term, in my humble opinion. And you're going to. It's not that hard. Some people say, you can't find anybody. It's like, what are you talking about? You can. They're there. You know, it's not like they're hiding under a rock somewhere. It's just that right now, what we're going to see is that the pundits, the talking heads, the self-proclaimed experts will tell you that nobody can beat the market, even though there are lots of people who have figured that one out. And that's what you're up against. There's a lot of misinformation out there. Slide number 9. Open-end funds versus closed-end funds. This is a discussion that normally most people would never even know. A distinction never would even know about the difference between open-end funds and closed-end funds. Why is that? Because open-end funds are far more popular with the general public. And closed-end funds tend to be more utilized by individual managers on behalf of their clients or fairly savvy investors who are looking for something very specialized. When people talk about mutual funds, unless they say closed-end, they're really talking about open-end funds. And this is a type of investment company in which the investor buys shares from and sells them back to the mutual fund itself. There's no limit on the number of shares the fund can issue. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. So at any time, you have $100,000 or $5 or whatever, $5, $50, you give them your money and they create the shares given the amount of assets they have at that time. And then when you ask for your money back, they delete those shares. So it's a little tricky when people look at their statement and go, I have shares. Yeah, you do have shares, but they're easily translated back and forth between dollars. So what I usually try to, some clients will get very upset. They can't understand it. And I'll sit down and show them how it works. Say you put $50 in and the mutual fund costs $50, you'll get one share, right? If the mutual fund costs $10, you'd get 5 shares. If the mutual fund cost $100, you'd get a half a share. I mean, that's how it works. It's not that hard. And so these are far more popular. Notice as of December 2018, there were 9,600 of these things, totaling almost $18 trillion out of that $21.4 trillion. About 80% of the mutual funds are open-end mutual funds. Closed-end mutual funds, on the other hand, are different, in that there are only a certain number of shares. The shares are issued by the investment company only when the fund is organized. And then after all those original shares are sold, you have to go to another investor to buy them. Now, you don't have to find that investor. You just call your broker because they're bought and sold on the open exchanges like this thing, I gotta delete this thing, excuse me, that I didn't put it on. Our IT department on my computer put on that Creative Cloud from Adobe, and they every once in a while come back and say, oh, don't you want to install this? I say, no, I don't, go away. I have to figure out how to delete that. But I don't know if I can. It's not my computer, it's Southwestern's computer, so I'll have to talk to IT. My apologies. So as I said, the shares are bought and sold on the open market to and from other investors. That's how stocks work. That's how bonds work once they're out there in the world. So you don't go to the investment company. You go to your broker. You incur brokerage commissions. And it turns out that these things are not that popular, and they're becoming less and less popular. Notice that only 4% of all the mutual funds out there are closed-end mutual funds. There were only, at the end of 2018, 506 closed-end mutual funds holding $250 billion. So 18 trillion, 250 billion. You know, see, both numbers recently have been shrinking. So it's not likely that you're going to get involved in the closed-end mutual fund world. Maybe you will. Maybe you'll find a fund that you like or somebody recommends to you, and you'll say, you know what, I like the way this fund is managed, and so I'll buy it on the open market. Slide number 11. Net asset value. This is something our book wants you to be able to calculate, but it's not, you don't calculate. You look it up, folks. You go online, you look it up. But that's the underlying value of one share in a particular mutual fund. How do you figure it out? It's actually very simple. You add up the value of all the securities in the mutual fund, and then you subtract out any liabilities, which is usually a small number. You know, they have to buy the more shares, they have to pay off some investors, they have to pay the rent or whatever. And you divide by the number of shares. So, and that tells you what one share of the mutual fund is worth. Every day, at the end of the market, when the market closes, the mutual funds are required to calculate their net asset value. Now, open-end mutual funds are sold at that net asset value, back and forth between you and the mutual fund. And if there's a sales charge, you add the sales charge. But closed-end funds are bought and sold on the open market. So their price is not necessarily the net asset value. And in fact, it's usually different. Not by much, you know, maybe 50 cents, 25 cents, but it usually will reflect a premium or a discount to their net asset value. And it turns out it's often with closed-end mutual funds at a discount. It's not that big a deal. They're very rarely priced at their net asset value, but it's not unless people believe there's something hanky-panky going on where the real net asset value is not what these people are publishing. But that's you know, very, very rare that anything like that happens, and it's usually turns out that there's somebody, you know, bad-mouthing the closed-end fund, and it turns out that it was not really true. But there are some people out there that do not the most nicest things to one another in the investment world. Yes. So here's the calculation for net asset value. And again, you don't have to worry about it. It's done for us. You take the value of the fund's portfolio every day at the end of the market's close in New York at 4 o'clock Eastern time. You subtract out any liabilities. We have to pay off this investor. We have to pay the rent. We have to buy some more securities. And then you divide that by the number of shares. So in this case, the value of the fund's portfolio was $10,050,000. I used really big round numbers. And we owe somebody 50 grand. And there's a 1 million shares. So you take the 10,050,000 minus 50,000, that's 10 million divided by 1 million shares. You get a $10 net asset value. And then if this fund has a sales commission of, say, 5%, the offering price would be the $10 plus the 5%, or $10.50. You don't have to do the calculation. I'm not going to ask you. You look it up. It's that simple. Slide number 13. Okay, so let's talk about the difference between an open-end and a closed-end fund. Well, what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? The open-end mutual fund is very easy to buy and sell because there's no market forces. You go directly to the mutual fund company or through your broker or through your 401k, and you buy the shares. And then when you want to get your money out, you sell the shares, and it's very simple. The open-end mutual funds are very popular. We saw there's 9,600 of the darn things. But one of the disadvantages, and this is not your problem, it's the problem of the mutual fund company. What if a mutual fund does really, really well? What happens? They get showered with love and affection and money. And all of a sudden, they got all these billions of dollars coming through the door. Now they have to invest them. And they sometimes they scratch your head and go, well, what do we do? Buy more shares of what we already have? You know, that might not be the smartest thing to do. So what some mutual fund companies will do is they will close the fund to new investors. You'll look at a list of mutual funds on a company's website, and they'll say, close to new investors, one of the mutual funds. And you say, why is that? Because they say, look, we can't take any more money in. If you already are with us, if you already are one of our investors, we'll let you put more money in. But we don't want any more new investors. Other companies say, no problem. Well, we'll take new investors. What they do is they add managers. And so what they basically have are mutual funds with mutual funds inside them, where they might have one manager who has 75 mutual stocks or 75 stocks, and another manager comes on board, he or she buys 40 stocks or 60 stocks. So they wind up having multiple managers inside a mutual fund. And then they say, we'll grow as large as we want to grow. And so some of these mutual funds have, you know, tens, $100 billion or more. And other people say, how can they manage it? Well, it's very simple. They've got multiple managers. And that helps with diversification, right? So I like that approach personally. I mean, I'm not in the mutual fund industry, but that to me makes a lot of sense. Closing the fund, and then what happens if it has a bad year? They open it back up again. Okay. And then they close it again, they open it. Some companies have done that. Now, what about the closed-end mutual funds? What are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, you have a little bit of a disadvantage that you have to pay the broker's commission, like a stock. You must buy and sell via the marketplace, so you might be able to buy it or sell it at a premium or at a discount. But now those are, you know, mild disadvantages. One of the major advantages of a closed-end investment company is they don't have to worry about new assets coming in the door or leaving the door. They know how many shares they have, and that's it. And they have as much money as they have, and that's what they work with. So it's easier for them. They don't have to worry about closing the fund and then reopening it if they lose some money. And so that's the advantage over a closed-end mutual fund. So which would you prefer? Well, dear students, probably you're going to be buying into the open-end mutual funds because that's what typically will be in your 401k. Yeah, that's how that works. But you might decide, oh, I like this closed-end mutual fund. And that's do your due diligence, your research. Now, slide 14, a new type of mutual fund. Well, actually, they're not quite 20 years old. Called exchange-traded funds, 17% of mutual funds typically, I mean, it's currently. This is an open-end mutual fund. So they can create more shares, destroy shares as needed, but they trade on the stock exchanges like closed-end mutual funds. So it's a bit of a hybrid. That's why they're called exchange-traded funds. There is no limit to the number of shares because it's open-ended. As people throw more money in or take money out, they can create or destroy shares as needed. But now you must buy them through a brokerage firm, like a closed-end mutual fund, incurring the brokerage transaction fees, the commissions. So you're going to pay $50 a month to an ETF and pay $8 for a transaction fee. No, what some mutual fund companies are very smart, Fidelity, Vanguard, they have created their own brokerage firms. Now, it's not the same as the mutual fund company. They're sister companies. They have the same name, right? But it's a different company. But it has the same name, Vanguard, Fidelity. And you can buy and sell their ETFs with no commission. Very smart marketing, you see, because they want people to buy their mutual funds, so they make it easier for them. And these were introduced in the early 1990s. They have become very popular, and we will discuss why later on. But because not only are they good long-term investments for we prudent long-term oriented, but they can work as trading vehicles for those people who are so inclined to go up against John Merriweather and buy and sell in the short term, because you can do it all day long and your brokerage firm is going to love you. But if you buy them, I should look this up, but I'm assuming that Vanguard and Fidelity put some kind of limit on how many times you can buy and sell these things within a certain time period, because, you know, they don't want you just buying and selling them all day long. Your brokerage firm does, because then they get, you know, ching, ching, every commission every time you buy and sell. Okay, so look at the growth of the ETF industry. It has just been phenomenal. It's just been unbelievable how the ETF industry has grown. What we see is in 2006, 359 funds. And then 2007, 629, 700, 800, 900. Now we're up to 2,000 as of the end of 2018. There is an ETF for every single investment strategy you can imagine. And the dollars have come in. Started in 2006 with a little over $400 billion, $600 billion. Notice in 2008 the drop, $531. It was a rough year. And now we're up to $3.4 billion. Now, it went down a little bit in 2018, because at the end of 2018 we had a bit of a they call it a correction, because it wasn't quite 20%. It was intraday 20%. Didn't quite do 20%, but it was 20%. That's a bear market. But in 2019 was a very good year for stocks, so when the data comes out, we'll see that that number is a bit larger, no doubt. But notice, yes, ETFs are very, very popular, and we will discuss why for some of the reasons. We already discussed a few. You can trade them and the like, but we'll discuss that in a subsequent presentation. So, because you're getting tired, right? Me too. I know. Our distance education coordinator says your things are too long. I said no, they're not. They're not too long. Enough to put people asleep, but not quite. Okay. Slide number 16. How are mutual funds regulated? The Investment Company Act of 1940. Well, as we said, the demagogues and the republicrats can play nicely in the sandbox when they need to. This was the foundation of the modern mutual fund industry. There were mutual funds before this, but the regulators were a little bit worried. What is this thing? You know, what do we do with it? And so the Congress said, look, we're going to define a regulated investment company. Remember, that's the legal term, as a pass-through investment vehicle. You know, when you make money, the IRS says, hey, you know, you owe taxes on this. But the mutual funds, no, it's not our money. You know, we're making it for these people, so go tax them. And the IRS could have scratched their head and said, well, I guess that makes sense. Well, now, after 1940, there was no problem. The Congress said, yes, the mutual fund does not pay taxes on the investment income they make. They pass through the investments and the, you know, gains to their shareholders. So the shareholders pay the taxes. Now, the mutual fund company makes money through the fees that they charge you. They have to pay taxes on that, yes, but no. On the investments that are in the mutual fund, the shareholders pay the taxes. Now, notice, let's read slide 16. To qualify, an investment company must hold almost all of its assets as investments in stocks, bonds, and other traditional securities. They have a very limited ability to use derivatives and other risky strategies. They don't want the mutual fund gambling with your money. They want them to be investing in bona fide, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, real, important, useful, good investments. And they must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring a particular security. Now, what are we talking here? Look, if we have 100% of our assets and we can put no more than 5% into any one individual investment, stock or bond, that means we must have at least 20 stocks or 20 bonds. You see? Now, most mutual funds have far more than that, 100, 200, 500, because we want diversification. But you from the outset, you can put no more than 5%. Now, every once in a while, in fact, one of the mutual funds that we'll take a look at later on, they have a couple of stocks where it's over 5%. What happened? Well, if they, if the stock had done really well, it might wind up being more than 5% of their portfolio. And they're not required to sell. They don't have to sell, but they can't buy any more. They can hang on to the stock or the bond or whatever, but they can't buy any more. They can't add to their position. So that's okay. It's flexible. And then they need to create an organization with checks and balances. Have you heard of checks and balances? That's what our country is supposed to have. It's supposed to. Anyway, and what are we talking about here? Slide number 17. If I had made this graph, I would have turned it upside down, put the shareholders on the bottom, but whatever. Notice the shareholders at the top, and they elect the board of directors. And the job of the board of directors is to oversee the fund's activities, including approval of contract with the management company and certain other service providers whose contracts usually represent the majority of fees paid by the fund shareholders. In other words, they're your watchdogs. And some are accused of being, you know, basically rubber stamps, and others do their job. So that's another thing you want to do when you research your mutual fund. You want to make sure that the board of directors is indeed on your side, working on your side. And then the rest of the entity is the mutual fund. So I don't know why I would have this one bar that just says mutual fund, because all those five boxes on the bottom are part of the mutual fund. So what do we got here? We got the investment advisor, whose job is the most important job. They manage the fund's portfolio, and they're usually the ones who get paid the most money. And it's if they do it right, it's an expensive job. They need, especially stocks and bonds, you need research professionals all around the world, because the world is global, speaking many different languages, and it's an expensive proposition to do it right. Some people just sit in front of a terminal and do it from their computer somewhere and who knows where. But other companies have global research teams, and they're the ones that we are going to take a look at. Then there's the distributor that sells the shares directly to the public or through brokerage firms, the distributor. There's the custodian who actually holds on to the assets. Interesting, right? The investment advisor doesn't actually handle the assets. They just make the decisions, and then they are required to tell the custodian, hey, go out and buy the 400,000 shares of Microsoft that we want. The independent public accountant then makes sure that they did what they said they're going to do. They say, okay, you say you bought 400,000 shares of Microsoft. Where are they? Show us the statement. And this is where people like Bernie were able to get somebody. He got an independent public accountant from somewhere in Connecticut, and the guy worked out of his garage. And he just said, hey, I got, you know, so much money. He wasn't buying them, but he was supposed to be buying bonds. I got all these bonds, and here's the statement. He had made it up, and the public accountant said, oh, cool, yeah, sure. He rubber stamped it. And then the transfer agent is the entity that actually buys and sells the shares back and forth to the general public. And then that entity is separate. A mutual fund company will be able to go to certain companies. You might have heard of State Street, maybe not. But they have a wonderful apparatus for mutual funds that don't want to have their own transfer agent and custodian for that effect, and they will handle all that for them. But most major mutual funds have their own in-house transfer agent. So you see, there's all these checks and balances to make sure that, you know, the thing is run well for the benefit of the shareholders, right? Make sense? And then these next two slides, 18 and 19, were basically review what we just went over in that graphic. So I'll sort of bounce through them pretty quickly. You got the mutual fund, which is a corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders, the investment advisor with their portfolio manager or management team or committee, the research analysts that focus on specific industries, the distributors that sell the shares to the public or to dealers through brokerage firms or directly to the public, and then the custodian that actually holds on to the securities at a bank or a trust company, and then the transfer agent who, you know, keeps track of all the purchase and redemption requests from the shareholders, and then the independent public accounting firm, which makes sure that it's all run on the up and up and there's no hanky-panky going on. So, on slide number 19, we ask the question, why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect the shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company, right? How until 2003, never. You had to go back to 1971 or 2 when there was some hanky-panky going on. In 2003, never. Wait a minute, Piano. Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, it isn't. It hasn't been. Since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of propriety. There was one little bitty fund back in the early 70s that guy ran away with $4 million. He was a friend of Richard Nixon, if you can believe that, and he made his way to Cuba. But that was it, right, until 2003. In 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. Only a handful of funds and people were affected. Strong Funds, Janus, Bank of America, Putnam, Alliance, just a few companies. Alliance Mutual Funds, they were a great company. Now they've merged, and we'll actually see them in the next presentation, one of their funds. They had two people in the entire company, and Alliance almost disappeared. Strong Funds, Janus Funds did disappear. Bank of America Funds, I don't know what happened to them. They got merged into somebody else. Putnam almost disappeared. Poor George Putnam rolling over in his grave. But they survived. They're still around. But Alliance, two people. The vast majority of companies, individuals in the industry, never engaged in any of these shenanigans. And what are we talking about? Well, it's a little difficult to explain quickly. But very quickly, they were stealing fractions of pennies from their fellow shareholders. How could you do that? Well, it's actually very simple. If you know how the mutual fund industry works, and if you know how the mutual fund industry works, you know that at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time at New York time, when the markets close, you have to find the prices of all the securities in your portfolio and come up with a net asset value. And that's what you buy and sell the mutual funds at the net asset value, not the ETFs, not the closed funds, but the open-ended funds. And so you see that the market tanks in New York, goes down 2%. Well, you know, a few hours after the markets close in New York, they're going to open up in Japan. And this has been something that's started back in the 1980s. The markets around the world started to work more in lockstep. If the market would go down in New York, the next day it would go down in Asia, and then go down in Europe as the world turns. And so you sold your Japanese fund because those prices are a day old. So more often than not, when the market opens in Japan, it will drop. You then the next day buy it back. You see what just happened? You see what you just did? You were able to sell high and buy low. Now, the difference might only be 1%, but who cares? You know, what do you care? It's no skin off of your teeth. You have $100,000, you made, you know, $1,000 or maybe $500. And what you're doing is essentially stealing from your co-shareholders, your fellow shareholders. It was not illegal, but it was definitely unethical. Some companies just wouldn't let you do it. I mean, some companies said, no, you can't do that. We're not going to let you do it. Like Vanguard and American, they just said, yeah, you can't do it. What American does is if you do that, if you sell one day, you have to wait 30 days to buy it back. You can buy something else, but you can't buy that. You know, they won't you do it. And if you do that enough times, if you buy and sell and buy and sell, they just say, look, go away. We don't want you. You know, you're not one of our shareholders. We want you to go away. Other companies like Oppenheimer, which is now part of Invesco, Franklin, I think. If you do that, they'll say, sure, we'll let you do it, but we're going to charge you 2%. So you, are you okay? We'll charge you 2% and give it back to your fellow shareholders. So you see, it was not profitable then. But these companies, they didn't have those kind of safeguards in effect. And so, yeah, two people at Alliance were doing it. Two people, and the whole company was tarred and feathered. So at the bottom we say, instead of losing $99,999.99 on a $100,000 account, maybe you lost a penny on a $100,000 account. But hey, if there's a million of you losing a penny, then you see that that's how it adds up. So it was a scandal, but it really wasn't as bad as people made it out to be. They were not illegal, but obviously unethical. And the one guy, you want to look him up, Mr. Strong, who started Strong Funds. Look him up, Strong Funds. He was disgraced. He was the CEO. At the time he was doing this, he was worth $600 million. And he was, you know, this probably made more money, but they figured he made about $80,000 doing this, extra dollars off the backs of his fellow mutual fund holders. What is $80,000 to somebody who's worth $600 million? Well, he was very contrite. He said, I've destroyed my life. I've let down all my friends and family and all the people who looked up to me, all my coworkers and the people who worked for me. He's barred for life from the industry for 80 grand for somebody who's worth 600 million at the same time. You see, this is what happens to people who become very powerful. They start believing the hype that they read about themselves and what people shower them with love and affection and money. And they think they're invincible. And I guess, you know, maybe some of them are, but some of them ain't. Okay. So you, dear students, will never have to worry about this, I assume. And you will work and act ethically, I am sure. Now, so that's our first presentation. Go back, look at it again. Make sure you know, make sure you understand what we've discussed. If you have any questions, contact me, because it's going to get a little trickier and a little hairier. In our next presentation, we are going to look at something that people try not to look at, and that is fees. And you, dear students, are going to be the experts. You're going to be the guru. You're going to be the go-to person when that 401k meeting happens or whatever, or your friends and family need a Roth IRA. And you're going to be able to explain to them exactly how they're being charged, because you are going to be awesome. See you in our next presentation when we discuss mutual fund fees.